This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Genocide and colonization are ongoing processes that continue to this day. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Bonus!
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 Hello and welcome back to Bonus Snack Pod, the monthly bonus podcast that we bring you lighthearted chats and deep dives into not quite so Auspol content. Normally, we would talk about how we don't have to introduce ourselves and that sort of thing because, you know, it's Bonus Pod, everyone knows who we are. But we've decided this month we're going to release this episode to everyone. So on that note, my name is Noon. I'm the co-host of the show, and with me, as always, is...
Hey, Zach Lesnack. I'm the other host of the show. Thank you for joining us, especially those of you who are not patrons. I'm glad that... I'm hoping that a few non-patrons get to enjoy this as well. We thought this is a good kind of a companion piece, I guess, to the regular show, because there's been a few things that we've wanted to talk about but haven't found time. And the way that this... The bonus episodes usually work is that we take suggestions from our patrons, $5 patrons and up. And usually the suggestions are for kind of, you know, let's talk about this piece of political jargon, or let's talk about something silly related to politics. But this month it was, we got the request to talk about marginalized, the effect of the corona lockdown on marginalized and otherwise oppressed people. So that's what we're going with this episode.
As you can imagine, it might be a reasonably heavy episode. And before we start, we do want to give just sort of like very broad content warnings. We're going to be talking about domestic violence and police violence and discrimination based on race and a whole lot of other stuff. I think just... open warning that there's going to be some heavy shit this episode, and hopefully next month we'll bring you some lighter content. But yeah, we thought this was important, and as Zach said, this is, you know, stuff that we've wanted to talk about in the main show but haven't quite known how to fit in this kind of analysis, especially when it's not sort of super news based. We're trying to do some more like theoretical and structural analysis about how coronavirus has made things worse for already marginalized groups. But on that note, I just want to say there are some people that we're not going to be talking about and some groups that we're not going to be talking about. Obviously, there's so many different marginalized identities and bodies and so on that are affected by this. And just some of the ones that we're not going to be talking about today are people in prison, older people, people from Asian backgrounds who've been copping a lot of racist shit, and trans and gender diverse people. And especially on that last one, I wanted to recommend a show called Worst Year Ever, which is really good. And they did an episode this week about, I think it's called The Secret War on Trans People or something along those lines. And I just really recommend, yeah, getting into that if you're interested in that. It is a bit more American, but yeah. So shall we get started, Zach, with our first group?
Yeah, sure. So first off, going to talk about the way that the COVID-19 crisis has affected women and children, specifically through the lens of domestic violence and what kind of effect that's had. So just to kind of set the scene a little bit, I guess domestic violence is already an epidemic in Australia, and that follows the theme, which has become, I guess, almost a bit of a cliche in corona coverage, that a crisis like this doesn't necessarily create new problems, just sort of worsens the ones that are already there. And domestic violence, as we already know, was one woman was being killed a week. I didn't know this until I did a bit of research for this episode, but apparently we declared a national emergency in regards to domestic violence in 2015. Now, you know, it's hard to say what kind of impact that has had. Obviously, it needs to be backed up with sort of solid
policy
before it means anything. But this is definitely, you know, acknowledged by the government and by, you know, wider society as being, an epidemic. So the first kind of thing I wanted to touch on was the economic stress that has been brought by the crisis with the shutdown and quarantining and, you know, so many people losing their jobs and that kind of thing. So in general, we know that financial hardship is a major aggravator of domestic violence in the first place. And it's important to note that it's not a cause of domestic violence. The only cause of domestic abuse is abusers themselves. But financial hardship can be is one of the sort of main indicators that can inflame abusive domestic situations. So already right off the bat, there's, you know, a huge kind of red flag there with this situation. And one of the other things that I came across that I thought was, you know, pretty telling, and you're talking, Noon, about how we were sort of wanted to step back a little bit and look at this crisis with a bit more of a structural lens. An interesting stat that I came across was that on average, women retire with 40% less super than men, superannuation. And one of the first things that the government did in response to this crisis was enable people to draw down on their superannuation. So obviously, you know, when your society is already massively unbalanced in terms of how much money you make based on what your gender is, then giving people, you know, telling people, oh, just draw down on your super, that's not an equitable solution at all.
No, and especially because the way that super works of compounding, like when someone takes out $10,000 now, that's like $30,000 they're losing in retirement, or, you know, it depends what age they are or whatever. But like, this isn't just a turn in terms of like, you know, obviously women are going to be able to access less money through their super because, as you say, women are paid less in our society. But also then in the future, it's going to entrench the financial disparity between women and men.
Yes. One of the many cool features of capitalism. A little bit off the top now is a completely fucked lack of retirement later.
Yep.
So big thumbs up on that one. So we do know that domestic violence has spiked during the COVID-19 outbreak all over the world, really. But, you know, obviously we're going to focus on Australia here. And it's really quite difficult to tell or get kind of any hard numbers about this kind of thing, especially considering that there's, you know, that we're in the middle of a lockdown. But one indicator is something that a survey that was conducted by Women's Safety New South Wales, they surveyed 400 of their frontline workers about what they were seeing on the front lines, basically, of the outbreak. And the 40% of those frontline workers reported increases in pleas for help, and 70% of those workers reported an increase in the complexity of the cases that were coming to them. So that's very significant, obviously. The other indicator that has been reported is that there's been a huge surge in calls to the Men's Referral Service, which is a helpline for men who have committed or are worried that they will commit domestic violence. And so on the day that the stage three restrictions were announced, which was towards the beginning of April, there was a 94% increase in the usual traffic from self-referred callers.
Holy
so
shit.
These are guys
that's
that are
enormous.
You know, yes, yeah, huge. And the distinction, you know, it's self-referred. These are
sure.
not, because this is a service to which the cops will refer, or, you know, basically
yeah, right.
mandate that people who have committed domestic violence have to call these. But this is from people who, yeah.
Self-referring.
Who are worried about their own behavior, yeah. Which is huge. So some of those callers have reported that they were using COVID-19 as an excuse to commit violence or exert control over their partners. And so we do know that it's having an immediate and direct effect. One of the other results of the lockdown is that face-to-face men's behavior change groups have closed.
Mm.
So there's a lack of in-person support
yep.
For these men. So, you know, but those services, you know, already have waiting lists, which are months long, apparently. And they serve, you know, like thousands of men. So these are services that are already massively kind of underfunded,
which is
under-resourced.
Yeah, again, I just want to keep drawing this point. And as you said, it's kind of a obvious line at this point, but the disaster of coronavirus is just making other like failings in our society and safety net and so on much more apparent. And when you've spent decades not funding, you know, crisis and support groups and counseling and mental health support and all this other stuff. Now, when there's a disaster, all this shit comes out and the months long waiting lists are now years long or whatever it is, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually on that note, this service, the men's referral service, is run by an organization called No to Violence, which is the peak body that are funded to work with men to end family violence. But they only operate in Victoria, New South Wales and Tasmania. That's all the funding that they get because there's no national service specializing in men's violence prevention, which is just mind-boggling when you consider, as I mentioned earlier, that we have officially declared a national emergency about this issue, that there isn't a kind of federal-level response to this. Is pretty mind-blowing.
Yep.
So one of the other things being reported about the effect of the COVID-19 crisis on domestic violence is that calls for help to helplines have actually in some cases dropped, and quite significantly in some cases. Some helplines were reporting drops in traffic of up to 30%. I'm just going to read this quote from the CEO of Safe Steps, which is Victoria's Family Violence Crisis Centre. And she said, this service has been going for years and we've never seen a trend down like this. From those that are calling, we are hearing of concerns about child custody arrangements and of being imprisoned at home in the name of COVID-19. Children are at home and not necessarily in sight of teachers, neighbours or community.
That's terrifying.
So, yeah. The theory is that basically these people who are in the, you know, living with very controlling or abusive partners basically aren't able to get to a phone and call for help because their communication is being monitored. They can't leave the house and use a payphone. We have a real, like, payphones are being shut down across Australia. And this is actually something that has a hugely negative result on the lives of people who are living with controlling or abusive partners. In the UK, for example, there are they have many, many more payphones, and they hadn't actually seen the same drop that we saw here in calls to crisis lines. So that was one sort of theory behind that. Obviously, you know, now there's basically no way for people who are living with domestic violence or abusers to get away or to contact anyone. So
there's been a lot
that's a really, really troubling element of this.
There's been a bunch of posts going around about that stuff about, you know, like message me about your orange cat and your black cat and that sort of thing. And there was some discussion on Auspol shit posting about how productive that sort of thing is. But anyway, it must be awful.
Yeah, it's
not being even able to reach out for support about that stuff.
For sure. And look, obviously those things are complicated but I think we do need to look at innovative sort of approaches to that. One of the things that's been reported internationally is that in France, women are been given... Yeah, exactly. That if you go into a pharmacy and give a code word, that they will understand that you are in an abusive situation and that will try to get you help. So... Yeah, I mean, there are definitely ways around it. Obviously, you know, these are the kinds of things that need to be worked out by experts in dealing with these situations and people who have a lot of experience with it. I just wanted to note, after saying that there was this dip in calls to crisis lines, that other helplines have recorded increases since then, which was about the beginning of April that this was first reported. So, again... Hard numbers and really solid information is hard to come by. A lot of the reporting is a bit piecemeal. You'll get certain ideas from one organization here, one helpline there. But the overall picture is that it's not good.
Yeah.
So one of the other things I thought that it was important to touch on here, and just kind of in general, maybe it's a good thing to note, is that up the top we mentioned that there are a few groups that we weren't going to specifically talk about. But of course... people from all kinds of different walks of life fit into many of these categories.
Yeah.
We might not be specifically focusing on a specific, category of person, but, there are lots of different ways that these various forms of marginalization and oppression intersect.
Yeah.
And in regards to women and domestic violence, particularly one thing that I've seen a bit of reporting around is the experience of migrant women. So... I have a quote here from the CEO of Southeast Community Links, which is a domestic and family violence service in Dandenong. That's a suburb in southeast Melbourne, which is highly multicultural. It's got like a 70% non-English speaking background population. And she says that migrant women without community or family in Australia are at particular risk. This quote from her says, family violence generally has gone quiet in terms of any reporting, but for migrant women in particular, you can imagine with all of the violence being contained in the home without any outlets available, it would just be totally compressed into the home. So, yeah, if we're talking about people who have recently emigrated to Australia, then, you know, there's a lack of family or community support if you're recently arrived. And so you've kind of got even fewer places to go.
Mm.
So that's an important kind of extra intersection. I guess it's important to think about. And one of the other elements of that, of maybe being, say, on a temporary protection or a bridging visa, is that you don't have access to government services. You don't have access to Centrelink. You don't have access to Medicare. And that can be really dangerous if you rely on, for example, a husband who is sponsoring your residency,
yep.
For example. And one of the pieces that I read around this that I thought was really good is a piece by Rick Morden in the Saturday paper. And we'll link to that. We're actually going to put together a list of all of our sources for this episode because, people have asked us to kind of look into it. And we'll share with you where we got all this stuff. But he mentions the specific story of a woman who was living with she recently came to Australia to marry a man as part of an arranged marriage. And she came with a child. And the man quickly became abusive and threatened to kill her and her child. And so she left him, and then he withdrew his support of her permanent residency. So he was sponsoring her her citizenship, or her permanent residency, rather. And so then she was left with no access to services, mm. no access to Centrelink. And then her job fell through because of the shutdown. I think she was working as a dentist's assistant from memory. And so she was having to ride a bicycle with Uber Eats, and with no resources or family or community support or access to services, she was having to take her daughter with her to work. So that's, I'd recommend reading that piece. It's obviously pretty harrowing reading. I guess important to recognize here that while we're talking about women and children and domestic violence sort of as a section, that obviously there are multiple different ways that people experience that, which are going to differ along various different other lines, including class and race and that kind of thing. So what is the government doing about this? Well, they've announced $150 million of extra domestic violence funding, which is part of a broader mental health support package, basically, that they've rolled out in the wake of the corona crisis. So most of that money is going to go towards counseling support for families experience family violence, the 1-800 Respect Hotline, Men's Line Australia, Trafficked People Program, and all sorts of other kind of support programs for women and children. One of the things that a lot of that money is going to go towards is relocating women and children from who are living in abusive situations, which is kind of in a way not ideal because you'd want to be moving the abuser really in those situations. Yeah. But obviously these things are very complicated, and this is where the pre-existing approaches that we've established before this crisis come into play, as you say. So that's that's not something that I know a huge amount about, but something that I came across in my research there. That extra funding is definitely good, and definitely a positive step. But this is the same government who just last year gifted Pauline Hanson a family law inquiry so that she could grandstand and perpetuate lies about men and fathers being the real victims of the family law court. So, this government is definitely no ally to victims of domestic violence. This funding is definitely going to go and be very helpful to a number of people. Mm. So, it's important to be critical of that support at the, as well as acknowledging it. So, you know, at the end of the day, I guess, as I mentioned earlier, it's really hard to get hard numbers about this kind of thing and hard to know exactly what the scale of it is going to be. But the sense that we're getting from people who are working in the field, who are on the front lines of this, is that the fallout from this is going to be pretty major.
Yeah.
And that when the lockdown is lifted, there's going to be a lot of emergency report required.
Mm.
So, you know, violence prevention workers are definitely braced for the end of lockdown.
Sure.
And finding out exactly what's been going on. And yeah, that's about all I had really prepared on that
mm-hmm.
subject. So hopefully that gives a little bit of an overview of what the situation is like. And I guess points out the areas where this crisis is putting extra pressure on the elements of that system, which are already kind of failing
yeah.
a number of people who are in abusive situations.
For sure. And if you're done with that, then I think we'll move on to the next group that we're looking at, which is First Nations people. And, you know, I've said this over and over again, and I'm probably going to say it like six more times before the end of the episode, but yet again, all of our existing inequities in our society are just being made stark by this virus. And one example of that with First Nations people is that the actual direct effects of the disease are going to be much worse in Aboriginal communities, and that's because they have much worse average health than the broader population, and that's because of centuries of ongoing colonial violence. And just for instance, Aboriginal people who are over the age of 50 are being given the same advice about social distancing as non-Aboriginal people over 70, and I think there's like a 17-year gap in lifespan basically between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal population. But that means that, you know, yeah, people who are over 50 are being told to like fully self-isolate because they're at an at-risk category in the same way that people 20 years older in the broader community are. And
I remember hearing that I was listening to Morrison's announcement and when he said that thing, and it was pretty shocking.
Yeah,
I guess. I don't know. It was just kind of a situation like this puts the government in the position of having to acknowledge
their
the
failures
truth about that situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it was, I mean, that's so kind of upsetting and bracing to hear.
And that's quite a generic kind of thing that I've said about having worse average health, but they are overrepresented. First Nations people are overrepresented in nearly every existing health condition. So heart conditions, lung conditions, kidney disease, diabetes, and there are several diseases that are almost non-existent in the broader population, like trachoma, which affect Aboriginal people. And that's not for sort of genetic reasons or whatever, because diseases don't really work like that for the most part. It's because of entrenched poverty and not like a lack of access to medical care and good food and all this other stuff. You know, fresh veggies and so on. And that leads on to the next point, which is that even people in remote communities who have relatively mild symptoms are going to have a much worse time than non-Aboriginal people or people living in city environments because there's so much less medical treatment available. And so, you know, for example, there's basically no ICU beds available in remote communities, and the ones that are available, there tend to be one or two, and they're in hospitals that are very far away. And so people are going to die from conditions that are treatable in other situations, which is exactly what happens with diabetes and with heart disease and so on more generally. Yeah. But
yeah,
there are other barriers to healthcare other than distance and sort of where you live. And obviously one of those is a financial one. And as we know, wealth inequality is correlated with race. So there are going to be more Aboriginal people who aren't able to afford treatment, who aren't don't have private healthcare, all this other stuff. And obviously in Australia, we have a reasonably good public healthcare service, but that does deal with some of that financial disparity, but not all of it. But the other thing is that our healthcare system is racist. And just for one example of this, this isn't about coronavirus, but is just an example of how Black people and Aboriginal people specifically are going to be excluded from care. So there's a woman named Naomi Williams. She was a Wiradjuri woman, and she died in 2016 of a treatable infection. She went to the hospital, and without being... she didn't get to see a doctor. She was given 2 Panadol and told to go home and have a rest. And before this, she had been to the GP 18 times and was never referred to a specialist. And the coroner in this case was sort of saying, like, as a white woman, she was shocked that, like, she had never had to go to a doctor more than twice to get a referral. Yeah. and so what's going to happen is Aboriginal people are going to present for treatment and with diseases and going to get told to fuck off. And they're going to die because of it and have other long-lasting impacts on health. And there's a quote here that I want to read from this Guardian article. Professor Yin Paradies, an expert in race relations and public health at Deakin University, said hospitals generally suffered from implicit racial bias that meant Indigenous patients received worse levels of care. The best data we have in Australia is that there are 30% fewer procedures for Aboriginal patients across the country compared to non-Indigenous patients, he said. And that is accounting for where the patients live, socioeconomic status, marital status, gender and age. He said Indigenous patients were discharged from hospital against doctors' advice at a rate 5 times higher than non-Indigenous patients. There's a strong correlation between treatment and Aboriginality, Paradies said. There is evidence of stereotyping Indigenous people as more likely to use drugs and alcohol, and so that sort of stereotype is very likely to be present in the minds of many Australians given its pervasiveness. And specifically in the context of this woman, Naomi Williams, she had told medical staff when they asked her about, you know, contraindications or whatever, she said she occasionally used marijuana to cope with severe pain and so was repeatedly referred to drug and alcohol services, despite having been to a drug and alcohol service and them saying, no, she has no dependence on this drug. She smokes it occasionally because she's in a huge amount of pain because she's got this fucking treatable infection.
Yeah. You won't treat her for.
That you should treat her
for. Fucking shocking.
Yeah.
Fucking shocking.
So that's, you know, a few years ago, it's not a corona-related thing, but it's a prime example of how our racist healthcare system is going to hurt Aboriginal people. Mm. So
no, it's a really helpful illustration, actually.
Mm. And up until now, I've basically been talking about systemic inequities that are being exaggerated, but there's more specific and, like, proactive harm being done to First Nations communities at the moment. And one example that I imagine many of our listeners will have seen was that there were Aboriginal people being forced to go to work for the Dole for, like, ages after the coronavirus was... that we knew about it and knew that people shouldn't be going to work and stuff. And here's another quote from a different Guardian article. The Peat Aboriginal Medical Service of the Northern Territory says it wrote to Federal Minister Ken Wyatt 6 days ago asking for work for the Dole activities to be suspended, quote, on public health grounds to reduce the risk of COVID-19 transmission in vulnerable remote communities, but did not receive a response. Wyatt's department wrote to providers to say mutual obligations remain in place at this stage, meaning that Aboriginal people will still be expected to turn up for group activities or risk losing their welfare payments. And of course, you know, we know what a fucking shit show Centrelink has been this month. And like, what are the chances that an Aboriginal person on work for the Dole who got their payments cut are going to be high on the list of having their payments reinstated once they, you know, apply for it to be back? Or, like, you know, I imagine that people did lose their payments and they haven't been restarted, though I haven't actually got confirmation about that. Anyway, a week after this article came out, the requirements for work for the Dole were finally cancelled. Yeah. But that was like a full 2 weeks after this Peak Medical Service had written to the minister. And that was like a full 2 weeks after we knew that this was a disastrous situation that people needed to not be going out. And as we talked about, these are two final points that I just want to make that we've kind of covered on the show, or we have covered on the show. One is that the Australian Federal Police going into the Northern Territory and breaking their own, like, quarantine requirements. And I've got this article here. There's a headline that I want you to tell me, Zach, what do you think the article is about? So the headline is this: NT police arrest 9 men for entering remote community without coronavirus quarantine.
I mean, it sounds to me like they've arrested a bunch of people returning home, but...
Close, yep. So they were First Nations men from a remote community on the Tiwi Islands who were visiting another remote community on the Australian mainland. and they were arrested because there was a tip-off that they were bringing beers and weed into the community.
Fucking hell.
Not because of any kind of coronavirus-related thing. And they were, like, fully arrested as well. Like, they... we've been hearing a lot from Scott Morrison and so on about, like, oh, the police are using their discretion, you know, we're trying to be careful and whatever. But... as we've seen for the entire history of the police force, when police use discretion, they use it to target vulnerable people. And these arrests are going to be like permanent fucking criminal records for these men. One of them was a child, by the way. Whereas, you know, that idiot who went to visit his mate at the cop station in DY got fined. And, you know... 6 months from now or a year from now or whenever coronavirus goes back, that guy's not going to have any trouble getting a job because he violated social distancing. But these men are going to be discriminated against for the rest of their life because they've had a carceral experience because they were, you know, the Northern Territory were quote-unquote protecting the coronavirus quarantine or whatever.
Whilst also sending potentially infected federal police officers into remote communities, which we know, as you've just explained, are at much higher risk if they do contract the virus. Like, yeah. And no, I think this is a really, that's a great illustration, I guess, of exactly how these racist and oppressive institutions will use a crisis as an opportunity to further over-police and incarcerate people who they were already doing that to.
And in the name of protecting those people as well. It's so gross. It's
fucking perverse. Yeah. It's totally perverse, especially as, you know, given the hypocrisy of that organization and their actions over the past few weeks.
There was a Facebook
post
that I...
Fuck the AFP, man.
Yeah.
Fuck those guys.
Yeah. There was a Facebook post that I couldn't actually find while I was making the notes for this. I read it a couple days ago, but it was some guy who owns a liquor shop or something in the NT. And basically, a bunch of cops hung around the entrance from when he opened and basically kicked black people out of his store all day. And then,
Jesus Christ.
You know, for corona-related reasons and, like, social distancing, oh, you can't go in or whatever. And then when he shut up, shut for the day.
Super corona-related.
Yep. The cops were like, oh, sorry you didn't make much money today. Anyway, as I say, I couldn't find a... confirmation for that, or like I couldn't find the original post, but yeah, I mean, cops are just like going around being fucking racist dickheads, but now with corona,
because why would they change their behavior now? If anything,
and
they'll just do it more.
Yeah, go on, sorry.
No, that's
yeah,
it. Go on.
Absolutely. Yeah, they've been given new powers to do the same shit harder.
And so much discretion. Discretion me harder, cop daddy. Fucking hell.
And again, just to finish off again, discretion, this is something we've talked about on the show, but Osman Faruqi gave these stats about where people were being arrested, and the suburbs that have high Aboriginal populations are being vastly, vastly overrepresented. I can't remember the exact number, but it was something like 10% of the arrests in a suburb that was like 30% Aboriginal or something like that. And again, they're using discretion to arrest people rather than to give them fines or to give them cautions or to give them move-on orders or all of this other stuff that would be equally effective. So anyway, that's the end of what I had to say about First Nations stuff. There's ongoing systemic health difficulties and fucking shit cops and fucking racist hospitals. It's a shit show. Yeah.
Total shit show. Speaking of which, next up on the ticket is talking about people who are in immigration detention. So, according to the government's own official advice, on their fucking website, they say that people who are in detention and correctional facilities are in the category of being most at risk of contracting COVID-19. So that's a list that includes people who have recently been near someone else who's tested positive for COVID-19, people who have traveled recently, people living in group residential settings. So they are actually talking about like the most at risk. So currently there are 1,440 people being held in a detention in Australia, in onshore detention. That includes people from Iran, New Zealand, and Sudan. About 40% of those people are asylum seekers. About another 40% are visa breaches. People have breached their visas in one way or another. And the other 20%, you know, represent a sort of variety of reasons. And the average length of time in detention is over 500 days.
Over 500 days?
Over 500 days. We've got to consider that a number
it's
of
like 2 years.
Yeah. Well, a number of the people have been held for 7, 8 years. Yeah. If you consider, you know, some people who were on Manus are still in detention in Australia.
I mean, I kind of knew that consciously, but just thinking average length 500 days, for some reason, that just really struck me. That's cooked.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's why I put the stat before, in here. Yeah, I think it's fucked. Yeah, you know, I think a lot of reporting about this, you don't really get a sense of the scale necessarily. So, yeah, I just thought that was an important bit of kind of scene setting, I guess, for this topic. So the first news story that really came out about COVID-19 and its relationship to people in immigration detention was early in March when an immigration guard who works for Serco, who are very cool and above board company. Mm-hmm. This guy was working at a Brisbane hotel, which is being used as a makeshift detention center. Tested positive for coronavirus.
The guard tested positive.
So a guard, an immigration detention guard working in Brisbane tested positive for corona. This is a makeshift detention center, which is being used to hold refugees who most of them were being held there because they were medevaced. So these are people who were specifically brought to Australia in order to receive specialist medical treatment. And one of the people guarding them has tested positive for COVID-19. So that's absolutely fucked. And from the Guardian article where I read about this, they have a quote from this from a refugee advocate who said that isolation is about trying to keep the virus out. If it gets in, everyone will get it.
Yeah.
And I just thought that really, I don't know, put this picture in my head of just, you know, you're stuck in this place, you can't move, you can't do any of the things that are going to keep you safe from the virus. Mm. You're just sitting there and waiting for it to happen. And then you find out that one of the people who is keeping you there has contracted the virus. Look, I mean, it's inconceivable to me.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, people who are in immigration detention, especially those who have been there for extended periods of time, are already physically and mentally, you know, at a huge deficit compared to the rest of the population. And we know that the medical services provided by the government are vastly inadequate. So the medical services are run by IHMS, a private company. IHMS is International Health and Medical Services. And they have been in the news a number of times because they are just fucking awful. You might remember them from being implicated, if not being directly responsible for, the preventable death of a man on Manus in 2014 called Hamid Kazai, who died of a preventable infection, because, but yeah, basically they didn't have antibiotics. He died from a lesion on his leg. And a really, really horrible and nasty death as well. So, like, you know, these guys are terrible. Yeah. It also came out later that they'd been running the medical clinic on Manus without a medical license. So, you know, we're talking super dodgy
here. What
the
fuck?
And these guys run, like, all of the medical services across the Immigration Detention Center in Australia. So, you know, this is what detainees are dealing with. So, later in March, various people, you know, across detention facilities, wrote a collective letter to Scott Morrison. I've got a couple of quotes from it here. They say, "We are sitting ducks for COVID-19 and extremely exposed to becoming severely ill with the possibility of death." And they said that immigration detention is, quote, "a potential death trap in which we have no option or means to protect ourselves." So, you know, obviously they can't self-isolate.
Yeah.
Many facilities have reported shortages of toilet paper, soap, and hand sanitizer, you know, coupled with obviously what we know is very substandard medical treatment. Mm. And the other thing is that, you know, as a result of the lockdown, that all visits have been canceled. So they don't have access to that one skerrick of psychological and emotional support that they might have been able to get from family or community who came to see them. So it's really a dire situation. So there have been a few protests going on from people who are in the immigration detention system, and some people in Villawood are currently conducting a hunger strike. I've got a quote here from one of the men who are participating in that strike. He says, we're not going to break or wreck anything, but this is the only form of way that we can reach out is by striking like this, to do not eat in order to get some form of attention. No eat, no drink. We are sick of being in the dark and being in the shadows. We are human beings, so we urge you, we are pleading with the Australian government to act now. The time is now before it gets here and it is too late. So, you know,
yeah,
these people are really, really scared and really, really desperate. And, you know, they were already in a terrifying and desperate situation before this happened, obviously. So, you know, what's being done about this at the moment? Really not very much. There are a number of kind of big official groups that have called for immigration detainees to be released. We're talking about like the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, the Australia's Human Rights Commission, Australasian Society for Infectious Diseases, Australian College of Infection Prevention and Control. So the list goes on.
So you're
obviously
talking about a bunch of bloody lefty hippies. Is that psychiatrists,
super
infectious disease
professionals? Yeah, progressive radical organizations. Yeah.
Yeah,
so it's a fucking no-brainer, is what, obviously.
I just want to say also, I'm pretty sure, and I'm sorry I don't have sources about this, but I'm pretty sure we are releasing people from regular prison, like not everyone obviously, but like people are having time taken off sentences and people are having bail restrictions lifted. So, because, you know, they're just like regular criminals. Why would we keep them in jail? But we will keep these like completely innocent people who are trying to seek a good life and have been punished for it and who are like legally seeking asylum in many cases. Like,
It was interesting because I actually haven't heard anything about... I know that people have been calling for prisoners to be released, but I hadn't heard about that happening. And, you know, it's sort of one of the major things that we're not talking about.
Yes, in this episode, yeah.
In this episode is people that are incarcerated, and a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about here that relates to people in immigration detention goes for people in prison as well. And as we discussed, like a lot of prisons are using like... prison lockdown methods in order to try and stop the potential spread of disease by putting people in solitary confinement, for example. And obviously, you know, it's a very different scale. We're talking about under 1,500 people in the immigration detention system, but in Australia, we've got a prison population of over 43,000. So, you know, the scale of the crisis is, you know, orders of magnitude bigger there. And I think it's something that we might try to get into in a later episode. There is also something, a conversation I think to be had around where progressive organizations and activists focus their energy. You know, I haven't heard that much conversation about prisoners in this situation, but there has been a lot of conversation and media coverage of people in immigration detention, which is not to say that that coverage shouldn't be happening, but I wonder if, you know, there's a certain... There's a distinction between, as you say, you know, these are kind of innocent people, you know, quote unquote innocent people who have come here seeking refugee status or what have you, versus, you know, I think there is still this mentality about people in prison, like, oh, well, you know, they've committed a crime and they kind of deserve to be there. There's not that same kind of activism on their behalf that I've seen anyway. But if you're right about people being released, I mean, that's awesome. And
so
look into that.
I think there's other stuff happening internationally, but I've just looked it up. And in New South Wales, there have been some powers given to release low-risk offenders from prison. It's unclear from this article about whether or not people have actually been let off yet. But basically someone, like bureaucrats, have been given powers to let people out of jail. So.
Sure. Right, interesting. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that. So there's also been protests happening from activists outside the immigration detention system, and one of those high profile ones, which we touched on briefly in I think it was last week's episode, maybe the week before, was a car convoy protest organized by the Refugee Action Collective in Melbourne outside of a hotel called Mantra, which is another of these sort of makeshift detention centers where they're holding people who have been medevaced. And I didn't realize this, and we talked on when we spoke about it, we mentioned that the cops stopped the convoy and took the details of everyone who participated. I think there were a couple dozen people who were part of the protest, and they threatened them with fines of over $1,600, and at least one of them was threatened with arrest. But I hadn't realized that they actually fully arrested a member of the Refugee Action Collective at his home.
Yeah.
On the day, they held him at the station for 9 hours, like took his phone, charged him with incitement,
That's right. I saw him tweeting like a photo of the act that he'd been charged under.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and, you know, I mean, again, coming back to the topic of police discretion, like the day before this protest happened, there'd been a convoy conducted by the United Workers Union for the No Worker Left Behind campaign, and they were left completely completely untouched by the cops.
Which is right and good, but it's fucked that then the people who are advocating for immigration detention-related issues are being charged because, like... Yet again, what a cop uses their discretion for is fucking with brown people, and
Yes, definitely not. Like, discretion should definitely not be a decision that we're leaving in the hands of police.
No.
Whatever. So you mentioned that there have been calls to release people from prisons in light of this crisis, and there have been similar calls, obviously, for people in immigration detention. So the organization Human Rights for All have started a public petition calling for the release of people seeking asylum and refugees. That petition has over 50,000 signatures so far. And it's something that's been done in other countries. Spain, Belgium, and the UK have all released people from their detention systems, usually under the threat of legal action from activist organizations. And I think that there will be similar actions brought
Right, because of a duty of care over people in detention, all that sort of thing, something along those lines.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
So the director principal of the of Human Rights for All, her name is Alison Battison. I've got a quote here from her. She says, families across Australia are struggling with the ramifications of COVID-19. The families of people in detention are no different. We ask that these families are allowed to bring their loved ones home to see out the pandemic. These people have safe and caring home environments willing to support them, either with a family member or advocate in Australia. So what she's talking about here is one potential short-term solution, which is community detention. This is something that was brought in about 15 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
Where basically, yeah, people are allowed to live in the community, but tabs and very close tabs are kept on them. So it's obviously still an awful situation to be in, but much less severe than, for example, being imprisoned in a hotel.
Yeah, I knew two guys who were living in community detention. I was sort of friends with the people whose house they were living in, basically, and they were constantly having to go and see parole officers, basically. It was probably not called parole, but something like that. There were a lot of tabs being kept on them. But they just were constantly being so excited and grateful to be in a normal bedroom and to get up and have breakfast and stuff. And they were just constantly overjoyed with the world. And it really touched me whenever I saw them. That despite the fucked situation that they were in, it was so much better than how they had been for the previous however long that they'd been in a detention facility. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, for sure.
Please go on.
No, well, I was just going to say that the minute you were saying that new powers are potentially being given in New South Wales to release prisoners, well, the Minister for Immigration already has the authority to release all of these people into community detention with the stroke of a pen, basically.
Yep.
But obviously... that's not going to happen because our government isn't going to radically change its entire ideology at the drop of a hat or the drop of a pandemic. The other thing to kind of note about this entire situation is that, our detention practices are already breaching fundamental human rights. Like, we have been condemned multiple times by the United Nations and the international community at large.
Yep.
We are violating people's right to not be arbitrarily detained. So, I guess we're coming back to the same theme which we end with every time, which is that this was already fucked and is only becoming more fucked because of the stresses of the crisis.
For sure. So next, and this is going to be our last little segment, I'm going to talk about disabled people, and I wanted to say thanks to AusBullshit posting member Ness Harkness, who I asked for some help, and she gave me some resources and has also been very active on the group posting about the way that disabled people have been experiencing this. And I also just wanted to say she encouraged me to use identity first language, so say disabled people rather than people with disabilities. I know other people prefer different language, and I just sort of wanted to mention that I'm going to try and use identity first language, but I will see how it goes. So to start off with, obviously comorbid conditions mean many disabled people are at high risk from coronavirus. And that's kind of similar to what I said with First Nations people. Like there's a higher rate of various diseases that are going to make the actual disease coronavirus worse. But again, what we're trying to focus on here is the systemic discrimination that's being empowered and exacerbated. And there were sort of four points that I wanted to address here, which is that one, social isolation disproportionately affects disabled people. Two, the general public acting in ways that directly harm disabled people. Three, there's official policy to let disabled people die from coronavirus. And four, there's at least semi-official people to let disabled people die from non-coronavirus-related causes. So I'll go over those in a bit more detail. But first up, social isolation disproportionately affects disabled people. And for people, for example, with mobility issues who need assistance showering and dressing and that sort of thing, physical distancing is basically impossible to live with. They need close physical contact for daily like maintenance of their life. And so they're at much higher risk of contagion than currently able-bodied people who don't need that sort of physical contact just to like get on with their daily life. And sort of conversely, I've heard stories about carers calling clients to tell them they're not going to come because they're worried about coronavirus and they want to socially isolate. But the carers aren't calling the agencies, they're not organizing replacements or whatever, they're just bailing sort of privately, if you will. And so then people with disabilities are often not in a position to advocate for themselves to nearly the same extent that currently able-bodied people are. So often those people are just kind of being told, sorry, you don't get life today. You don't get to shower or get dressed or have lunch. Bye. And I'm not trying to like dunk on carers or whatever. Obviously many carers are in difficult situations as well, but like, yeah, this is another example of how social isolation, which might be sensible from the point of view of the carer, like trying to avoid being in contact with other people, is directly and disproportionately affecting disabled people.
It's an interesting, like, yeah, there's so many cases where there's a tension between, you know, what you say is something that is, you know, maybe reasonable for, you know, a carer to want to try and social isolate and protect themselves, but it's going to, you know, we live in a system that means that those decisions have ripple out effects that affect really vulnerable people. And one of the other things that reminded me of is that we spoke on the show before about how it's kind of fucked that teachers are expected to continue working throughout this crisis.
Yeah.
You know, it's starting to change now. But, you know, one of the few places that children who live in violent homes are safe is at school. And so if schools are shut down, you know, that's one less that can really negatively affect, you know, kids who are living in abusive households. So yeah, there's a number of ways and places where we see these similar dynamics being played out. And of course, you know, it's you don't really want to apportion individual responsibility for this. This is something that we should have collectively already figured out.
Absolutely.
On behalf of these people.
Yep. I'm trying not to talk too much about like specific disabilities or different medical conditions or whatever, because there's just so fucking many and there's not, I think, a huge amount of value in me kind of going condition by condition or whatever. But I guess I have so far been talking about people with physical disabilities who have mobility difficulties and that sort of thing. But people with psychosocial disabilities, those conditions can be majorly exacerbated by social isolation. And so, for example, depression or anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorders can all be sort of really significantly made worse by social isolation or by like fear of the disease and all this other stuff. So people's sort of actual conditions and symptoms are becoming worse as a result of the world in which we're living at the moment. So to move on to my second point, which is that the general public are acting in ways that directly harm disabled people. This is a quote from a really good video by a woman named Jessica Kellgren Follard, who has a YouTube channel, Miss Jessica KH, and she has a series of disabilities and chronic illness and so on. And so it was a really good video called Busting Coronavirus Myths that I'll post a link to. She's a very charming, very British, very gay YouTuber. And there was this line that I liked. There was, as someone who deals with being ill every single day, watching healthy people panic about the possibility of doing so is very trippy. Which is maybe a lighthearted angle to start this note on, but a much more upsetting example of that is there's a quote here from Raina Lamb, who has a disability, and she said, "People who can stockpile are the ones who are probably less at risk because they're able to rush out to the shops, whereas a lot of people with disabilities and chronic illnesses just can't do that. Panic buying of groceries, hand sanitizers, and other protective equipment, which her support workers need, also has her worried. So on the one hand, she can't go out and buy toilet paper, but also her carers can't get gloves that they need to work with her and that sort of thing. And also, the general public are acting in ways that make things worse for disabled people, like panic buying. And this is sort of a crossover with another point that I want to make, but Trump has been talking about this drug, hydroxychloroquine, which is an anti-malarial drug, but is used to treat lupus and arthritis and other things.
And Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I think he and Rita Wilson...
they got it after being...
Yeah.
Right. Well, this is a great fucking example. They don't need that medicine. There's no real evidence that it's going to help them work. But there are people with chronic disease like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis whose conditions are just going to be much, much worse because they can't get this medicine. And that's one specific example. But people are panic buying all kinds of bullshit that they don't need, but the people with disabilities do need. Sorry, disabled people do need.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point.
Mm. So the third issue is that there is like straight up official policy to let disabled people die from coronavirus. And this is often called triage or like case management or that sort of thing.
Deciding who needs my medicine most.
Yes. And here's a tweet from Gregory Mansfield at GH Mansfield who says, "Categorical exclusion from life-saving treatment because of disability is not rationing. It is ableism, it is eugenics, it is discrimination, it is a death sentence."
That's pretty clear-cut.
It is pretty clear-cut. And that's, I think, luckily not really happening in Australia yet. We're not at that sort of past the flattened curve point or whatever where we do need to be seriously rationing ICU beds and that sort of thing. But obviously in Italy, this has been going on from day one. People with disabilities are being turned away. People over certain ages are being turned away. People with chronic conditions are being turned away from fucking treatment for coronavirus. So the official policy is like, fuck them, let them die of coronavirus. And normally it's not couched in those terms, but that's what it is.
And betrays the obviously pre-existing attitudes that were already there. Like,
absolutely.
Your life is just simply not worth as much as somebody who is not disabled.
This is definitely something that I feel like has been happening a lot on the internet of people being like, oh, but what else are we going to do? You know, like, what? It's just logical to choose people with disabilities and old people to not get treatment or whatever. But as you say, Zach, that's only logical if you think that disabled people are worthless and if you believe that so fundamentally that it doesn't appear to be a value judgment. It's just like a fact of the world that disabled people are less important. And just as an example, a different, equally logical approach that we might do would be like, people born in January aren't getting treatment today, or people with an odd street address or whatever. Like in China, they restrict traffic. They like cut down on traffic by saying people with license plates that end in a 9 can't drive today. And like, you know, everyone gets to drive someday, but like not everyone gets to drive every day. And that is a completely logical way to deny people treatment when we hit a peak. And if that seems like cruel or callous or impersonal or unfair, isn't it still miles better than being like, oh, yes, the vulnerable, those are the ones that we should kill? I don't know. I think that point about it's logical or whatever just really, really illustrates the fundamental way in which people think that disabled people are worthless.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge problem with the idea of like applying logic to these kinds of situations. And it's an issue that, you know, some of our quote-unquote greatest philosophers, you know, especially utilitarians, run into. Peter Singer is a particularly notorious proponent of these like extremely poisonous ideas of like, if we can reduce the, you know, if we can put a hard number on how much somebody will get out of living their life, then we can make very sensible decisions about who should get medical treatment or who should get X, Y, and Z treatment. But of course, you know, like, I've literally read quotes from him where he was like, yeah, if I had a child who had a severe intellectual disability, I'd be really sad because they wouldn't be able to fully enjoy Woody Allen movies. So this is the kind of, like, thought processes. He actually fucking said that.
Yeah,
these are the kinds of thought processes that we're dealing with here. And he can say that kind of thing with a straight face and apparently believe that he's making some kind of statement of hard fact and logic and reason. You have to be so unaware of yourself and unaware of your own biases to say something like that and believe that you are, you know, making some kind of unassailable statement. It's just, it's
this
so
This is
trash.
A little sneak preview of the Marxist meme series that we've got coming up. But Slavoj Žižek says that ideology is when something appears to be politically neutral. And I think this, like, logical, impersonal decision-making that disabled people are worthless is just a perfect example of that, that it appears true and apolitical to say that this is logical or whatever, but that is actually the point at which it's the most political, right? It's saying these people are basically not people or they're worthless. Whatever. That's the most political statement you can make in some ways. And it's hidden in this guise of impartiality and like, that's just obviously true. Anyway, I feel like we've spent enough on that one. I want to move on to my last point, which is that there's at least semi-official and sometimes official policy to let disabled people die from non-corona-related causes. So that previous one is people going and seeking treatment for corona and being told like, now we don't care about you, no corona treatment for you. But people are dying of other things. So this is from an article from the New York Times that I'm going to quote here. In January, Patrick Carr, a sociology professor at Rutgers University, suffered a relapse of the blood cancer that he has had for 8 years. Once again, he required chemotherapy to try to bring the disease, multiple myeloma, under control. But this time, as the coronavirus began raging through Philadelphia, blood supplies were rationed, and he couldn't get enough of the transfusions needed to alleviate his anemia and allow chemo to begin. Clinic visits were cancelled even as his conditions worsened, and he died on April 16th. And his wife says that she thinks that he is a death attributable to corona that won't be counted in any of the coronavirus statistics. And, you know, as we've been saying, like, obviously that's in America where things are vastly worse, both on the corona front and the, like, universal healthcare front. And, like, in Australia, that's not quite the situation that we're in. But the same things are no doubt going on where people's conditions are being ignored, the treatment that they need to have a bare minimum quality of life, like being able to use hydroxychloroquine. Fuck, I always say that wrong. Hydroxychloroquine. Things like that, and going to be able to see occupational therapists and all this other stuff that let people live good and whole lives are just being taken away and rationed and all this other stuff that just means that people are suffering and dying. And just to finish this off, I wanted to read a tweet that's kind of in a completely different direction than anything that I've been saying. And this is from Coset the Table, at Coset the Table on Twitter. And they say, "This isn't just a disability issue because disabled people are dying disproportionately. It's also a disability issue because some of the people who survive will be new members of the disability community." And this tweet is a reply to someone else that I decided to read afterwards. And there's a tweet from Lillian Field One. Who says, "A 25% pulmonary function deficit that takes 15 to 20 years to heal, some sort of coagulopathy present in a third of the patients, long-term implications not clear, neurological deficits. Do you really think the only smell and taste are affected?" And so this is just an example about, and I'll post a link to this whole thread that David Lillian Field put up, but he's talking about how people are like, "Oh, it's just a flu or whatever. People are dying at a rate about the same as the flu or whatever." And he's saying, "Well, yeah, but the flu doesn't cause these like ongoing neurological damage and it doesn't cause all this other ongoing condition." So I guess this point is that people who are currently able-bodied, who think of themselves as not disabled or whatever, are going to catch coronavirus and then acquire a disability as a result. So anyway, that is sort of, as I say, a whole new topic and direction that I didn't really have space to do more in for this episode, but I wanted to kind of leave that thought there because it really provoked me and I think is worth thinking about when we talk about how we treat disabled people in this current situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that overview on that topic, Newt.
No worries.
So that brings us to the end of this extra long bumper, extra serious bonus episode. I hope that you have gotten something out of this. And I hope that we've covered a few things that have sort of maybe been missing from our analysis on the show.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is just a snapshot. As we said, we're leaving out, you know, the experiences of many different groups of people. So, you know, there's so much reading and understanding to do about this situation. So to that end, as we said, we're going to put together a list of the sources that we use for this episode if anybody is interested in doing further reading. And if you want to chat about this, we've also opened up a free channel on our Discord, which you can access. I don't even know how you can access it.
I'll post a link in Ozpol shit posting, I think is probably the best way. Yeah.
And if you don't have Facebook, I think that I can make a permanent invite that I'll put that we can put in the show notes for this as well. So yeah, if you're interested in chatting more about this, if you think there's anything that we left out that you want to mention or any angle on some of the stuff that we did talk about, you'd like to chat about, come and join us there or in the Ozpol Shitposting Facebook group. Yeah, we'll see you on Sunday for our regular episode where I'm hoping to do a whole bunch less research and talk a whole bunch more shit. Until then, I hope that you stay as safe and well as you possibly can. And make sure that you keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.